Hi, it's Andy. Doug is still on vacation somehow. Not sure how we pulled that off, but we have a very exciting show today. We're going to go down memory lane, a decade of Mets history with Terry Collins. Doug is gone for one final time on this Shea Anything. He's back on Friday with Keith Hernandez, but I'm very excited to be here with Terry Collins. Terry and I go way back to the first days of his Mets tenure when I was on the beat and he was the manager. So we're going to go down memory lane today. As soon as I remind you to subscribe to the Shea Anything podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Shea Anything is now brought to you by Verizon. That's 5G built right for the Mets from the network more people rely on, only on Verizon. Terry, hello.
Hi, Andy.
Thanks for joining me. I mean, we needed a guest host for one final show with Doug on vacation. I really wanted to take the opportunity to spend a half an hour or so with you and go back.
Well, we've talked, you know, in the last 10 years, we've talked a lot of baseball, you and I. So
we sure have. So I'm excited to share some of that with the public. And just so the listeners out there know, Terry, you might have been the last of a breed. I mean, there's a lot of managers out there who are really good guys, including Louis Rojas, and you can talk baseball with them. But I used to be able to plop down in your office and talk about the game like it was 1950 or whatever. I mean, you were always totally willing to talk about, to the extent you could, there were things you couldn't say. But one thing I always appreciated about you is if I came into your office and said, hey, I don't understand why you didn't pinch run for that guy in the eighth, or you had the left on left or what, you never thought I was insulting you. It was always like you understood I was trying to learn about the game, and you would just say, oh, because they had the lefty up third or this guy on the bench and or whatever the answer was. And I go, oh, thanks. And I learned something. So I always appreciated that about you. And I hope I wasn't too annoying when I was asking all those questions.
Absolutely not. And, you know, every manager has thoughts. You know, one of the things I always thought that the media didn't understand is when they ask a question was, you know, we think on both sides. You know, before you make a decision, you think, hey, look, I could do this or I could do this. And as you gather your information, then you make the best decision you think is right for the club. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But when it doesn't, they'll say, well, why didn't you do this? Well, you know, yeah, that's easy to say after the fact. But, you know, we used to sit, you know, like you and I used to come in and sit down and talk about different things. And, you know, I don't have all the answers, never did. And I don't think any manager does. But, you know, it's fun to sit there and talk and hear perspective from, you know, from other people.
How difficult was it? Just like emotionally after the heat of competition, literally 10 minutes after the heat of competition, maybe you're actually upset with yourself in some cases about a decision you made. I mean, when I mess up at work, I don't always have to justify it to like 12 people right away. Was that hard to keep your temper and your patience when you had to answer those kinds of questions sometimes?
Well, there's no question. There's no question it was, Andy, but I go back. You know, when I was in the minor leagues, even as a minor league manager coming up, I used to spend a lot of time watching the major league managers. And when I finally got to the major leagues with Jim Leland in Pittsburgh, he used to have me come in his office every night as one of his coaches and sit and listen to the writers that came in, the questions they asked, how he answered them. And he said, look, you don't have to say the same things, but one of the things he taught me was to respect the media. And you know what? No question is dumb. There's no, you know what? There's some guys, you got a guy who's really young. He doesn't understand the game. He might ask you something that's off the wall, but you know what? Hey, look, just explain it to him. And you don't have to get riled up, but yeah, once in a while, you got to, you know, bite your tongue and say, you know, I like to say something else, but you got to treat him with some respect, in my opinion.
Yeah. You're always good with that. There were a lot of annoying people around during your time and you only snapped at him once or twice, I think. So you held it pretty well. I want to start with, kind of want to just go back to the timeline. You came into the organization, obviously, as the field coordinator that year in 2010. And you had that whole group. This is not something you and I experienced together. I was covering the Major League Club, obviously, at that time. Omar's last year. But you had Henry Mejia, Wilmer Flores, a little bit of Ike Davis, a lot of guys that came up and then contributed for you in the big leagues later. And some guys who weren't able to contribute in the big leagues. What did you see in 2010 that told you there was a perception when Sandy got here that the farm system was barren off of Omar? And I don't think that was quite true. So did you think working with those players in 2010 that you guys had the foundation of a good era ahead of you? And, you know, sure enough, in the World Series 5 years later, did you see that coming to some extent as field coordinator?
Well, you know, you got to remember, Andy, I had been the field coordinator with the Los Angeles Dodgers at one time, and I also was the farm director at the same time as the field coordinator. So, you know, when I came in as with the Mets, the one thing you do is you look at, you try to judge the players and say, hey, look, what can this guy do to help a big league club? And, you know, we had some players, Lucas Duda, you know, like you mentioned, some of the pitchers. Wilmer Flores was just a young kid at the time. But you saw the potential and you said, you know, down the road, hey, look, we've got a chance to be pretty good. But the key was that really helped me was I had seen these guys play and I knew their strengths. And matter of fact, there was a couple of times when Lucas Duda got to the big leagues and, you know, one of the things he said to me, when I got to learn to pull ball more. And I said, whoever told you that? You have power to all fields. I saw him one day when he was playing in AAA in Buffalo. I saw him in a 5-game series and he had 5 homers in different parts of the ballpark. And I said, you know, that plays in the big leagues, man. You know, it's so hard to teach a player to hit the ball the other way, and yet you can do it naturally. Don't think you have to shy away from it. But it really helped me down the road when these guys got called up. I knew them as people. I knew them as players. And it was a lot easier for them to make that transition once they got to the big leagues, I thought.
So you spend a year of doing that behind the scenes, that kind of player development work, which obviously I know you're very passionate about. First time I met you comes at the end of that year. We're at the GM meeting somewhere. No, it was in Florida. I think it was in Orlando. And you came down to interview for the managerial job. And I remember sitting outside the suite with the other reporters waiting for you to come. Sandy and Paul DePodesta and JP are interviewing you. You come out of the room. It's like, we knew the stories about you. Like, you were supposed to be intense. We knew how it went in Anaheim. We knew that you were a player development star. And at that point, you weren't necessarily thought of as a future manager. That was seemingly to us in the media behind you. So that's the first time I saw you. I know what, that's what I was thinking. Do you remember what you were thinking in that interview room with the Mets front office coming out and facing the media? Did you think that you were about to get another run as a big league manager? Or did you pretty much think you were going to be in St. Lucie through your 60s there?
I really did. Andy, I did not think I was going to get another chance. You know, when I left the Angels, I left because, you know, as I said in the day I resigned in Anaheim, you know, look, if I'm the reason why, you know, our club's not playing good, then I don't need to be, I shouldn't be around here. So, you know, when I got the chance, I always thought, well, you know, they're interviewing me because number one, I am a former major league manager. I do run the minor league system. I am aware of what's here. So I thought it was kind of a, hey, look, being a very courteous to bring me in and interview me. I had been through many interviews the time before. You know, I had interviewed when Omar was the GM, when Willie Randolph got the job, I was one of the 3 finalists there. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, Omar had something. Hey, let's bring this guy back. We almost hired him anyway. So, but there was something that, you know, Sandy and I hit it off, and, you know, I was very, very blessed and very lucky that he ended up picking me as the manager.
What sparked that in that room? Because Sandy, in some ways, you and Sandy have different, in many ways, have different baseball philosophies and even different personalities at times. I was outside that room. I wasn't in the room. Were you in there thinking, huh, I can talk to this guy? Did you feel that spark in that first interview that might actually work with you guys?
Well, also, Andy, one of the things that really helped was Paul DePodesta. You know, Sandy had hired Paul, and Paul was the general manager when I ran the minor leagues for the Dodgers. So we had, Paul and I had a very good working relationship, and we were good friends. And yeah, when you were sitting and when you talked to Sandy Alderson, I mean, this guy has the knack to listen, to offer something. And like he said later, you know, he thought I brought something different to the table. It wasn't just the same guys thinking the same thoughts. And you know what, as we all know, when you talk about leadership, hey, look, you've got to have some people on your team that have a different opinion, that can look at the other side of something or look at it a different way, so you can come up with the best decision to make your team better.
Yeah. Coming out of that too, it's interesting you mentioned that you're like a forgotten piece of both Dodger and Met history from the decade before, because Paul wanted to hire you to manage the Dodgers. And then Paul found himself suddenly out of a job. So that was that in LA. And then a lot of Met fans don't know this, but I'm glad you brought up Omar. Nothing against Willie, because that's who they obviously chose. I understood that Omar really wanted you to be the manager before the 2005 season. It was important for everyone to have a New York connection. And that was, I think, that helped Willie. Do you ever think, like, what if I was Met manager in 05, 06, 07? That would be a completely different history for you and the franchise.
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, for sure. They, of course, Willie had great teams, and you know, I wasn't aware of what really happened after that. But you know, those first couple of years, they had good teams, man, and he did a good job. And yeah, I totally understood the circumstance. I thought Willie was the right choice at that time. Yeah, and you know, I bring a little something different to the party than some guys do. But you know, again, I thought when my time came, I was ready to manage again. I go back, you know, when Jim Leland left the Colorado Rockies, you know, he sat out a long time before he went back to Detroit. And it's time to kind of, you know, look inside and say, hey, look, what do I need to change? What do I need to fix to make this work? Because the players are changing. The dynamics of the players are changing. And I thought that through my years as the field coordinator, as the farm director, I learned better patience in the minor leagues. I went to Japan where I got back to be able to instruct again. So there were some other things that happened along the way that I think really helped me when that job with New York came up.
Yeah, it worked out the way it should have worked out, because you were ready when you were there to relate to that new generation of player. That was clear. Your excitement was clear. I remember, and I'm wondering if you remember, you guys opened in Miami in 2011, your first game back as manager since the late 90s. Remember, you guys were at the old stadium in Miami.
Okay.
Did you have butterflies at that time? Or you just like, let's go? I remember looking like, I like this guy. I'm excited to get to know him. I wonder how this is going to go. What was that like for you that night?
Well, I was excited. I was excited to be back in the field. You know, I'm a baseball lifer, and I, you know, I loved managing. I really did. And those jobs are very, very difficult to get. So when you get one, you know, you really got to, I think there's got to be a tremendous passion to do the job. And one of the things I thought about when I got the job with the New York is, hey, look, I got to enjoy the job more. I got to quit worrying about, you know, wins and losses are going to come and go. I got to quit worrying about that with every loss that I'm responsible for it. That, hey, look, go enjoy the game. Keep your players positive. Keep them prepared. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. And the approach really helped me a lot more this time around than it did in the beginning.
One day I remember where you were not in a good mood, justifiably that first year, was the trade deadline. You guys got out of the gate better than people expected. Not quite good enough to convince the front office to go for it that year in terms of wins and losses in July. I think we were in Cincinnati when they traded Beltran. And I remember walking into your office and there was like sense of frustration, like, oh, now, you know, now you're a selling team. The next 2 months, you're going to be possibly playing out the string. I know you knew that was going to happen, but was that a tough pill for you in the clubhouse that first year when it actually, you do lose your star player, the front office does tell you, hey, we're still rebuilding. What was that day like for you?
Yeah.
I never asked you this.
And you were right. I did. I was prepared. I knew that was, those things were going to happen, but I will tell you, I loved Carlos Beltran. His presence in our dugout, in our clubhouse and on that team was invaluable. You know, we had David Wright, and we all know what a great person, a great star he was. But Carlos was kind of, he was kind of the glue. And, you know, there were certain guys like Angel Pagan. And, you know, whatever Carlos said, Angel was buying into it. And so
remember Beltran used to go, Pagan.
Yeah,
and Angel Jose, would like appear at his side.
Right, and Jose Reyes was the same thing. I mean, those guys loved Carlos. So when we lost Carlos, I felt that was a real big piece. But, again, I really had to make sure I relayed to the players, hey, look, you know what? This is part of the game. We've got to move on. We got to continue to, you know, play hard. We got to continue to stay positive, because you just never know what's going to happen down the road.
You were always so good at that in the early years, inspiring a team that wasn't going to win the division on paper to win more games than they were supposed to win. You guys always overperformed, even in those years during the rebuild. And that was a great example. Clearly, the team sells on July 31st. You're playing out the string to an extent. What was the trick to getting guys to play hard as they always did through into September in those years where you were not going to be in the playoffs? How'd you do that?
Well, you know what? I did it. As you remember, Andy, I used to walk around the field during batting practice and just talk to every player. And a lot of times, one of the things you had to relay to them, hey, look, guys, you know, you better understand something. You know, you're fighting for a job here. You know, don't think for one second that when this season's over, we're going to say, well, he had a bad September, but you know what? He was down in the dumps, because, you know, that doesn't fly. Nobody feels sorry for you in the major leagues. And you've got to grind it out. And those players that you see grind it out through adversity, those are the guys you're going to want down the road when it's time to really compete. And so those are the kind of things I try to spread to the players and let them understand, hey, look, you're still being watched and you're still being analyzed. So go out and play the game the right way.
next year, you guys had the Dickey Cy Young season, which was another big highlight of your early years before you guys became a playoff team. That was such a fascinating season. I don't think I've ever told you this, but the night before RA's book came out in spring training, you know, he and I were friendly. I liked him, and we were at the Carrabba's in St. Lucie, and he was so nervous about having to talk about, you know, his sexual abuse that came out that he put out in the book. And then I thought it was really brave to talk about it in the clubhouse, in a sense. And then he goes out and wins the Cy Young, and you can't quite believe that it all played out that way. Rewinding to that moment, though, the beginning of the season, when his book came out, he was in the news for things that were really difficult, and you're just trying to run a day at spring training. How was that for you? Did you have to talk to guys, like, to make sure that was going to go smooth? Did you have to talk to RA about the book? And how did you think that that was going to affect him and the team at the beginning? That was a big story.
Yeah, you know, it was a great story. And as you know, RA, he's very, very easy to talk to. And especially after he wrote the book, where he let his emotions out and he let his past out. And so I thought that was kind of a relief for him, as we've heard a lot of people talk about, you know, once you finally, you know, bury your soul, you feel better about yourself. And RA did. And you know, throughout the entire that summer, we talked about a lot of things. But, you know, when he explained that stuff to the players, and he did a lot of individual stuff too. One of the things that the general thought is that you have all these team meetings. Well, you don't. Players get tired of team meetings, but they don't get tired of the one-on-one conversations. And I think that's where RA made the biggest impact with a lot of the guys on the team, was one-on-one. And then he went out and he performed. You know what? He performed at a magnificent level and held himself accountable on a daily basis. And I think guys read into that. I think the players see that. And a lot of times they can forget about that stuff that's on the peripheral that they have no control over. And you know what? And just worry about this guy's doing the best he can to help our ball club. And he's been honest about his past. And I just think it made it a little bit easier for RA.
So he went around and had individual conversations to prep guys for that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. He was such an intellectual bookworm, kind of different from the average athlete kind of guy. He loved you. What was your trick to relating to him? Just what you just said, the one-on-one conversations and respecting who he was and he put out there? Because you guys had that connection, I remember.
Well, we did. Well, you know, it started the year, you know, when he got sent down, when I was the field coordinator, he was, I think, maybe even the last guy cut by the Mets, by the big club. And he came down, you know, we had a facial hair policy in the minor leagues that he had to shave. And I called him in, I sat him down and said, look, you're not going to like this, but you know what? You've got to shave. That's just what we have to do here. And so we sat and talked about that for a while. And just like you say, he was an intellectual. So he said, you know, my kids have never seen me without a beard, my children. And he said, I've got to figure out a way. And he did. So he went home and made it a party that the kids shaved him. And he came back the next day all excited to tell me how much fun it was to get his family involved with him shaving his beard. And that was RA. That was that great personality that came through. And from that point on, you know, the next year, you know, this guy's pitching like crazy. And he had, believe me, there was a lot of conversations between innings once in a while. I said, how you doing? And he never, and as good as he was pitching, he just said, listen, you know, we got a chance to win this game. I'm starting to lose it. You know, he wasn't afraid to say that. And, you know, hey, look, we got to win this game. And then down the road towards the end, you know what, I was dying to get him 20 wins. And that's when I called him in one day and said, look, I'm thinking about going to a three-man rotation. Can you do it?
Three-man rotation.
Said, yeah. If that's what you need, I'll do it. And that's what sold me. I said, this guy is a team player. Wow. You know what? A lot of guys in today's world, especially, well, here's a chance for this guy finally to get a huge payday. And yet he's willing to sacrifice perhaps wear and tear for the fact that, hey, look, if that's what you need, I'll do it.
You were going to go to a three-man rotation?
Four-man, but, you know.
A four-man rotation, right. Yeah, but yeah. 3 days rest. Yeah, so how – and that's interesting because he was chasing an individual accomplishment there, and I'm sure he was wearing down at the end of the year. People don't remember, too, he threw that knuckleball hard, so that probably put more strain on his arm than you think knuckleballers can throw all day. But I'm not sure that he was quite like that. Do you want to hear when a pitcher, it's probably a fine line, because what you just described to me, him being like, I'm tired, I can't go, that can annoy a manager too. But I guess you just appreciate the honesty.
Yeah, but you got to remember when he did this. We're talking eighth and ninth innings. We're not talking the fifth inning. Right. Like, you know, we're talking about a guy that's already gotten deep into a game, and you know, and he could sense it. you know, and he just said, look, I'm not, you know, if I'm going to make mistake with the knuckleball, it's starting to lose it. And, you know, I'll tell you who else did had a big impact in is Josh Toley. You know, Josh caught him all the time. And Josh once in a while would come in and give me a wink like, hey, it's stopping, you know, the big movement stopping, you know. And so those two guys really worked together, and it made it just kind of easy. But when I really wanted this guy to win 20 games, and when I told him that at the end, he just said, you know, hey, if that's what, you know, if you want, let's sit down and talk about it. And we did. And again, I think in the back of his mind, he just said, you know what, if I can do this and help the team, I think that's what's going to be best for the club. We didn't do it, but that was certainly something we thought about.
Wow. So we're going to have more memories coming up in a sec. First, I want to remind you that you're listening to the Shea Anything podcast brought to you by Verizon. It's 5G built right for the Mets. And the network more people rely on, only on Verizon. Terry, because we've been friends for a long time and because you've done a lot for me, I'm not. The two topics I'm skipping today are Wilmer Flores and the World Series. We're just not doing it. You've done it enough. And people can find those answers elsewhere. So the only time I'm going to bring up Harvey is a night that was really, really special. And in 2012, that summer night in the desert in Arizona, he comes out, strikes out 11. I don't know what the Mets – front office and scouts were telling you. They were telling us after he had pitched in Buffalo prior to that start that we're going to call him up, but he's not necessarily ready. Like, fastball command's not there. Player development wise, we're rushing him a little bit. And then he comes out and he just looks like an ace right out of the gate. Did he surprise you that night in that debut with how dominant he was? And what did he show you in doing that?
Yeah, he shocked us. I mean, you know, my pitching coach, who was outstanding, Danny Worthen, you know, that first inning, he walked out there in Arizona, and Danny and I looked at each other, and we're like, where did this come from? You know, Andy, I get a daily report. The managers get a daily report from every day from the minor leagues. And I followed, you know, we all knew Matt was the big prospect. And so I followed all his minor league starts and called the AAA manager about him, the AAA pitching coach, to find out what's going on. And he was 93, hit 94 once in a while. You know, they talked about his good breaking ball and his changeup was getting better. But, you know, he had a 3.6 ERA or a 3.7 ERA in AAA, which is pretty good, but it's not dominant. Right. And then he walked out on that mound in Arizona, and that was dominant stuff. And I, as you and I talked about, it wasn't long after, it's probably maybe three or four starts later, he came in my office one day and he asked me, he said, why do you think it took me so long to get to the big leagues? I said, because the guy that's in the big leagues is not the guy we heard about in AAA. If you would have done that in AAA, you'd have been here 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. And so I think when he finally got his chance, he was going to show people that, hey, look, you know, I'm here to stay. And he did that.
He found something. And he was impatient. That's right. Because you had him in spring.
Right.
2 years, I think, prior to him. Two spring trainings, I think he was with you. Did he seem like one of those guys that was itchy to get up there? And was he in your office? Was he comfortable telling you that, you know, he feels like he's getting close to ready to go, even before he got to you?
Well, the year we end up calling him up, that year in spring training, he came into my office. He said, you know, I appreciate, thanks for inviting me to camp, but I came here to make this team, not to be seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? And he didn't make the club out of spring training, but I'll tell you what, when he came up, he was certainly ready.
The impact that must have had on the rest of you guys too, because it was still a rebuilding time, not that exciting a time on the Mets in the sense of getting close to making the playoffs or anything. And then this guy comes out like he's a guy. I mean, what, you know, like that, it was something that the Mets hadn't seen in a little while. Did that galvanize you and the staff and the players just to have someone up there who was like that kind of star, had that kind of presence?
Yeah. You know, Andy, one of the things, and you've been around now long enough and see these young players when they first come up, how they act. And yeah. There's one thing that the veteran players look for. And that is, hey, look, you know, how arrogant are you going to be now that you're a big leaguer? And Matt Harvey did it exactly the right way. He sat in the clubhouse, listened, didn't talk much unless he was asked to talk. The guys would go to dinner. They'd ask him to go with them. And I heard the stories. He'd go and he was just a part of it. And so the veteran players really grabbed him and said, this is, you know, hey, look, this guy, he just wants to be a member. He just wants to be a good teammate. And that, you know, that and the fact that he was so dominant, I think, you know, really solidified the fact that they all said, this guy's going to be a real good member of this team. And, you know, until the injury started pouring up, this guy was as good as there was in the game.
So when the following year, I think, refresh my memory, because this just popped into my head as you were talking about him relating to the veterans. The time that John Roush, I think, poured the cold water on him and Harvey was like ready to go. You know, was that right away or was that the next year? And what I want to ask you about it is, well, remind our listeners what that was exactly. And then was that something that was viewed as like good for you for sticking up for yourself? Or was that pushing it with like, hey, rookie, you got to take your hazing a little? What was that like, that whole thing?
Well, you know, Matt had dealt with some of the hazing stuff that, you know, the rookies go through. And you know, all he was, again, he had been accepted by so many of the other guys on the team that when John threw the cold water on him, he was shocked by it. And again, you know, and John Roush, who had kind of a sketchy relationship with the other guys on the team, you know, when Matt went after this guy, they kind of said, hey, look, we like that. You know, we love the fact that, hey, look, I'm not here to take your stuff. And, you know, I'm here to help and do my job, and you don't have to treat me like dirt anymore. I think I've earned my stripes. And all the guys supported that.
He had the right instincts to know when the moment was where he'd earned the right to stand up for himself.
That's correct.
It was appropriate. Yeah, that makes sense. And don't forget how, like, it's not a small thing to stand up to John Roush. I don't care if you're a professional athlete. You're talking about a guy who's like 7 feet tall, his eyes bugging out of his head, tattoos. Remember one time I went up to him to ask a question. He's sitting in his locker all quiet. Reporters did not tend to approach this guy. He didn't give off like approachable. And I said, John, you have a moment for a question? He just looks at me, goes, regarding what? I said, hey, you know what? Never mind. So Matt standing up to him, you know, that I'm sure that did earn him some currency. So now into the good years. One of my favorite memories of you, and I wasn't in town for this because I was covering something else at the time, but I loved seeing it on TV, and I still like being reminded of it when I see the video of you spraying the champagne on the fans in Cincinnati after you guys clinched the division in 2015, because I think that fans can get so wrapped up in disagreeing with a manager's in-game moves that sometimes with you, they could forget that you were one of them. You had that connection. You were just as passionate about the Mets winning as they were. And you celebrated it by engaging with the fans in that clincher. Did you ever think you'd get to that moment with the Mets, as rough as it sometimes was roster-wise the first couple of years? And once you were there, what made you decide to engage with the fans in the stands that way?
Well, first of all, when you visit New York, when you are on the visitor side, you are, one of the things that captivates you is the intenseness and the knowledge of the fans in New York, whether it's the Yankees or the Mets. These people love their baseball and they love their team. So when you go in, it was always, as a visitor, you always wanted to beat the Mets or you wanted to beat the Yankees, especially in New York. So you bought into the passion of these fans. And yeah, they're allowed to have an opinion. Andy, I mean, that's part of life. You're allowed to have an opinion. You know, just because it disagrees with mine doesn't mean it's bad or wrong. And so, but when during those playoffs, especially at the end, that last home game we had before we went to the playoffs, that place, we erupted when that game was over in support of our team. And so, yeah, you've got to engage in that. And so we got into playoffs and, you know what, I just kind of fell into the energy of everything when I walked out on the field. You know, when we used to travel, I was shocked about how many Mets fans there were at all the other ballparks. And here we are in Chicago or in LA or wherever. I mean, and there's thousands of Mets fans. And so when we came on the field, and even in Cincinnati, you know, when we came out after we had clinched and had our stuff in the clubhouse, they were still there. And that just tells you the passion that they have. So I just wanted them to be a part of it all.
Is it hard to keep that appreciation of the fans when you are getting, any manager in New York, just getting beat down every day? Aaron Boone and Luis Rojas know more about baseball than probably almost anyone out in New York City. You turn on the radio at any moment and you're hearing about what morons they are. It's, you know what I mean? Isn't it, you just tune that out? There isn't any part of you that's like, you know what, now that we've won, like, bleep you guys. Like, forget it. Like, or do you just understand that it's all part of it?
It's all part of it. It's all part of it. And that's, you know what, and that's what one of the parts about the game. If you're going to play at the big league level, you better understand you're going to have people that disagree with everything you do. There's some people that don't like you, don't even know you. You know, and I've got letters of hate letters and awful mail that, right. You know, people don't even know me. And that was one of the things that, you know, people used to say to me was, you know, they I wish they got to know you, is that you do care. And I said, of course I care. They know I care, but everybody hates losing, and especially in New York. You know, you're expected to win in New York, and you're expected to play well in New York. And I get that. So then that didn't bother me a lot. You know, I was harder on myself a lot of times than the fans ever were.
That's true. I used to watch you after losses coming out. If you remember, I used to sit, and I got my moves too, and I used to sit by the doors outside of the press conference room. So if I needed you for a private question, I could catch you on the way out. But I would know, I don't know if you know this about yourself, but I would know that if you kind of blew through the doors and then whipped your belt off right away, like before you even got into the clubhouse, not talking to you tonight. I'll ask you tomorrow. It was all about the belt. No. Yeah, I'd be behind the doors. I'd follow you, and I'd try to get in step with you and say, hey, that pitching changed, da-da-da, and you'd go, oh, yeah, he was hurt, or whatever it was. But if you were two steps ahead of me and whoosh, belt came out, I'm not approaching you. And I could tell you were probably, you know, beating yourself up for something that happened or stewing about something that happened.
Right.
2016 is a very successful Mets season that flies under the radar probably because of what happened in 15. You guys going to the wild card game with no DeGrom for the rest of, you knew if you were making it, DeGrom was out. James Loney, no offense to him, but at the very end of his career as your starting first baseman, Duda wasn't even playing well enough. So, you know, there are all kinds of issues with that team, and you made the wild card. Where do you list that and your kind of in your memory of achievements, your time with the team, somehow getting into that wild card game in 16?
Well, I will tell you, Andy, you know, I was very, very proud and extremely, I mean, 2015 was the dream season. 2015, you know, after 2015, we lost Dan Murphy, who was a big part of our team. And so we had to fill in some holes, and we ended up bringing Jose back, and he's playing third base because David was out. And, you know, we had a lot of, you know, we call up a lot of young players to help us. So at the end,
Selman and Lugo came up. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, we had a young team. So for us to get to the playoffs, I thought, and to get into that wild card game, I thought was a tremendous feat by a young team. I was as proud of that team as I was of the 2015 team, because that was a battle at the end of that season to qualify for that playoff game. And of course, you're sitting there at the end of the year, knowing you got a chance to get in the playoffs, and you know that you're going to have to face Madison Bumgarner. And so, but you know what? You said, I'll take my chances. Just, you know, I'll take my chances to get there. It's so hard that you got to enjoy that time. And 2016 even though we lost the game, was a very, very exciting season in my life.
I should remember this offhand, but I don't. You didn't have Harvey by that end of that season, right?
No, he was out. Yeah.
That's right. So I know you didn't have DeGrom. You didn't have Harvey. I'm just curious, when a team is going into the postseason and like, well, we don't have Harvey and DeGrom, are you thinking, well, we're not getting to the World Series? Or are you thinking, let's go with Lugo and Gesellman? Is it hard to not get down when you're missing your horses like that going into a postseason?
No, we weren't down, because we were, again, we started playing so good. You know, you go back to the Cabrera home run against the Phillies. I mean, our guys were riding a pretty big high, even though we knew we didn't have some of the stars. But you know what? You, again, Andy, the one thing you have to learn if you're in the big leagues, and that is, when things are going bad, nobody feels sorry for you. And, you know, I've always said, you create your own expectations. And so we had a team that was expected to play well and win. And so all we kept doing, hey, look, I was so proud of our minor league system for producing players that came up and helped us. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, in 2015 and 2016, there were nights that I put 9 players on the field that were drafted, signed, and developed by the New York Mets. And mm-hmm. I don't think there's very many teams that can say that. And so, you know, certainly a development guy, I was very proud of our minor league system. So when we got into that game, and you know what? And Noah, You know, I will tell you, you can say whatever you want about Noah Syndergaard. This guy pitched two of the biggest, he had two of the biggest games in the in my tenure with the New York Mets of any pitcher I had. The night in Los Angeles when he came in against Justin Turner, struck him out, and in 2016, or even game three in the World Series that year, and the next year pitching against Madison Bumgarner, pitch for pitch, and being a young guy. Those were two big outings for him.
You remember that Granderson catch? What was your reaction to that at the time in that game? What a catch that was.
What a catch. I mean, what a catch. And again, as you know, one of the great, great professionals I've ever been around.
Do you think he had a beat on that ball? I mean, he wasn't at his best at that point as an outfielder. He was on the backside a little bit.
That's right. I mean, it just, but again, you know, those kind of guys, they make things happen. They just, you know, you count on them, and that's, and they know that, and they just, they're talented enough to make adjustments. And, you know, Curtis is certainly, we were really, really lucky to have him, you know, in our organization at that time.
Is feeling after that game an immediate sense of pride, or are you heartbroken because it was so close?
Well, the way it ended, I was really heartbroken because Noah pitched such a great game. And, you know, Jurice had 52 saves or something on the season. And, to have him take the loss after a tremendous season was really hard, because I really felt if we got past that game, you know, who knows what could have happened. But that was such a well-played game up until that night, till we did three-run homer. But, again, when the season was all said and done, I thought, look, as hard as it was to get here, you know what, we got here. Somebody's got to win. Somebody's got to lose. But we didn't give it away. You know, we went out and played hard.
Is Familia, who probably underappreciated because there's been, unfortunately for him, some high profile losses, is he better than people might think at bouncing back from those? Because he's had a few real heartbreakers, and then he has revived his career a couple different times. How's he after one of those? Is he like, all right, we'll go get him, or is he in a bad place after a blown save like that?
You know, well, I mean? I think he learned. When he became the closer, he had to learn about. He had to learn to, hey, look, blow it off. And certainly early in that tenure when he became the closer, you know, if he had a rough night, first thing you got to do is go pat him on the back, give him a hug when the game was over, and say, hey, be ready tomorrow. And, you know, hey, look, and show the confidence. I say a lot on the shows that you and I do with SNY. Hey, look, your players have to know you believe in them. You know, and they had that to remain confident in their abilities. And so that was a big push with Jurice. And I think he understands, hey, look, it's all part of it. The greatest closers in the game. You know, I remember beating Mariano Rivera a couple of nights. So, you know, the greatest closers in the game are going to get beat once in a while. And I think Jurice has got over that. But again, he's such a good person. I mean, the Mets have done so well of bringing in and developing good people who care. I mean, I used to drive this guy to the bank in his first year in the big leagues because he had to send money home to take care of his family. I mean, who does that? His thought process is, hey, I got to take care of my family first. So, you know what? You always rooted for those guys. I still root for them today. And, you know, I'll tell you what, this guy, again, his time has caught up to him a little bit maybe, but I saw him the other night through 98 still. Remember that great sinker. But, you know, I'm sure the wear and tear has beat him up a little bit, but his confidence is still good.
Yeah, he still has that 98 sometimes. You're right. Not as much as he probably used to, but as much as he can struggle at times, the fact that he can come back and have that, it probably shows some mental fortitude that I'm not sure he gives credit for.
Right.
One more reminder to subscribe to Shea Anything at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And a reminder that the Shea Anything podcast is brought to you by Verizon, 5G built right for the Mets, from the network more people rely on, only on Verizon. Terry, one of the reasons I was happy to do this with you, excited, of course, today, and so glad you're with us on SNY now, is the world is finally getting to see what I saw, just how much you enjoy talking about the game. You alluded to it earlier, like if only people had the chance to get to know you. Well, now they do. So I'm glad you've decided to stay engaged enough. You used to tell me, and I thought you were full of it at the time, but I wasn't sure. You said, when I retire, I'm changing my number and none of you will ever hear from me again. Well, it didn't work out that way, did it? Because it's been, you stopped managing in 17 and here we are talking in 21 over right. Zoom. So you can't stop talking about baseball, can you?
Yeah, I really got lucky, Andy. I really enjoy this. I, you know, the shows I've done with you guys on SNY, and I did a thing with Fox 2 years ago before COVID hit. And that was so fun to go out and you sit there with, you know, Frank Thomas or Dontrell Willis or Nick Swisher or Eric Karros and sit there and talk baseball. I mean, it's so fun. And these shows that we do, this is fun. I mean, you know, to sit here and, you know, I was really, really lucky. I was in a great organization with great support from the ownership to the general manager. And I know, you know, Sandy and I had our moments, but you know what, you're supposed to with your boss. I think, you know what, again, when you have differences of opinion, there's nothing wrong with sharing those differences of opinion. So I was very, very blessed that, you know, all the time in New York and the great support that I had. But I'll tell you one thing, I had good players. And you cannot win. I don't care how smart you are. I don't care how much you know about baseball or analytics or anything else. If you don't have talent and you don't have players to go execute, you're not going to win in the big leagues.
Well, we're supposed to be done, but I got to jump on this because you said Sandy and I had your back and forth, and you lasted a long time with him. So it was a successful collaboration. Still relevant question because he's there again. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for Sandy, but what was the most challenging part of being the manager for a guy who was so into process and analytics and stuff like that? What was the hard part about working with Sandy?
Well, I will tell you this, you know, Sandy came in my office every night, a lot of times before the game and after the game, but he came in after every game and he would question some of the stuff I did, which he has every right to. But you know what? I used to say this for, you know, I know he was into numbers and I, you know, by the way, I used a lot of those numbers to write my lineups once in a while. But they weren't the end all for me. You know what? You have to go with your gut once in a while. You have to know your players. And you know what? Hey, look, there's going to be a night where this is maybe a bad matchup for David Wright. He's playing. He's going to play. He's, you know, he's one of the best players in the league. And I've always thought this, you know, if you go to the ballpark, Andy, and you've got your kids and you're going to go watch the Mets play, there's, you know who you want to see play? The stars. Mm-hmm. You're going to go there to see David Wright play. And if you know he doesn't play, because, well, you know, geez, we're facing Max Scherzer, and that's a bad matchup. You know, if the fact that he maybe had played 14 or 15 in a row, or he might be a little fatigued, that's one thing. But it's another thing to not deny the fans who pay for everything, you know, whether they watch TV or listen to the radios or come to the games, to not have your star players in there because the numbers they might have aren't really good. I don't think that's fair to the fans.
So, and the last question on that, and then we really are going to be done. Clear this up for history. Sandy would give you his front office would give you the information and you'd make lineup decisions, or the front office would occasionally tell you what the lineup is. I think I know the answer to this, but
Sandy never did that with me. Times have changed. He never, ever took the lineup card away from out of my hands.
Yeah. He was in the game long enough to respect the chain of command, if you will, where that was the manager's job. They can have preferences, but you write the lineup. That's what I thought that he would do. Yeah. Terry, thank you. You go on for the rest of the afternoon, but they're not paying either of us.
It's good to see you. Good to talk to you.